It's Sunday, January 24th, and you are listening to Peanuts and Popcorn. P&P is a spontaneous podcast between two old friends on baseball and motion pictures. I'm Tom Hockney.
And I'm Leo Fontana. This week on our special Hot Stove Edition of Peanuts and Popcorn, Henry Aaron passes, as well as Don Sutton and Tommy Lasorda. Que descansen en paz. The Miami Marlins choose their new GM, and the New York Mets fire theirs. The Cleveland Indians announced their intention to change their offensive nickname. Are pitchers cheating to gain a competitive edge? How are they doing it? And we'll look at the remaining free agents. All that, plus the hot stove is fired up for the White Sox and the Cubs. And our movie this week is Death to 2020. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing pretty well. It's funny because yesterday I told my wife, I said, hey, the podcast is starting tomorrow. And she says, well, that does me no good.
How is Gwen?
She's doing very well. We're holding up during the age of COVID.
Yeah, no, it's tough. I'm back to teaching in person. It's a hybrid schedule where I basically have in no class. I still teach all five of my classes, but I never have more than six students at any given time, as many of my students have still opted to be taught, you know, from home online. Mm-hmm. And it was my best week teaching, in almost a year, so.
Now, is this you saying this, or is this some governing body recognizing you as Mr. Two-Week Teacher?
No, I'm talking about just the way I enjoy it. The way I'm able to connect with students and do the things that I need to do as a teacher. And that's primarily make sure they're doing their work, because it's very, very hard to make a student do his work when he does not want to do it. When you're doing it on Zoom, it's hard enough in regular circumstances, and I don't want to fail kids, and I don't want to fail kids in a pandemic.
Right.
So that's kind of, this is what we all struggle with in the profession. How can we give kids credit for being present during all of this?
And it's just really hard. In our last episode of last season, you were lamenting how difficult it was. So obviously it hasn't improved.
It hasn't improved.
Not materially anyways.
Not materially. I mean, I'm not saying that I don't have good moments. I have some really good students who are trying very, very hard. And I love going back and forth with them and teaching them and mentoring them. But there are just a few out there who won't say a word, Tom. They won't communicate with me on the chat.
Right. It's understandable. I think it's understandable. These little brains are not developed yet. I mean, you're asking a lot. And I'm going to be the first to tell you, if I was a kid today, I'd be fighting you tooth and nail on this. And the reason is because I got my Game Boy in one hand. The distractions are going to be enormous, and it's going to be very difficult for you to focus. It's almost an impossible task. It's almost like, herding cats or something like that. It's almost impossible.
I'm not going to be able to get every one of them. But you know what I wanted to mention too is this week, or the week before, I was doing online classes when something happened in Washington on January 6th.
Yeah.
And I didn't see this had happened until basically I was kind of, finishing everything up, and I just switched on, the CNN link, and I'm like, what the fuck? Yeah. This is the craziest thing we've ever seen, Tom.
Yeah. It just harkens me back. I wasn't around for Pearl Harbor being bombed, but I clearly remember September 11th, and my wife, I was working from home, and I never had a TV on in my home office. I do today almost all the time, but I never did back in those days. And she said, I think you should need to turn on the TV. And I remember for the remainder of that day and for some days afterwards, I felt as though I was suffering through PTSD, whatever they call it.
PTSD, you had post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah, correct. So when this happened, I started having those feelings again during the day. It made me think like, okay, this is more horrific than September 11th. Because that was a foreign agent that had a clear-cut beef against us. This is the calls coming from inside the house. Get out!
From within, yeah.
Yeah.
This is from within. The enemy is within, is us.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest part about that whole thing to swallow. Yeah. And you know how you're like, what they did, and exactly.
Just
feel it back. And then you see the Trump and the Giuliani speeches that happened ahead of it. And you're are you kidding me?
I know.
You know, but what I will say, you know, even though they did damage the Capitol and again, a policeman died and a protester was shot. And I don't want to minimize.
You can't
minimize any of that, but they were really, I mean, that's no way to run a revolution.
Okay? Right.
No way to plan an insurrection. They were really, really stupid. And the one thing I'll say about this is that they certainly made it easy for the feds to find it.
Yeah, exactly. At one point in the investigation, they said anybody that accessed their phone in the Capitol, understand now that every photo on your phone has been downloaded to the FBI. Every single photo on your phone. So you're right. There was a lot. There's so much to unpack here. We could do a whole show on the subject, and I'm not really going to do it because part of it is political. And part of it is what I call and have been reading about, and you'll read about it more as the days go on, the big lie. The big lie of why all of this happened, of Trump started planting seeds in the summer that this election was going to be rigged.
Yeah.
That he had no chance. If he lost, it would be because of irregularities. Anyways, it leads all the way up to what happened on this day. And I sat there thinking, watching this on TV in horror, that, you know, if these people want a uncivil war, just like the last civil war with the Confederates, you will lose even worse than they did. I'm telling you right now, because like you referenced, it's a bunch of hayseed, Jethro Bodines. A lot of these are white supremacists. Let's call it what it is. And all these guys that have carry all this military and we're all gung-ho, they're the fastest, biggest cowards when a war really starts. That's been my
Well, experience. And I'll remind you that Trump said that I'll be right there with you, you know.
Yeah,
and,
in the bunker. In the bunker.
I mean, seriously. Right. That was the worst planned coup attempt I've ever seen in my life.
But I think as the days run out, and the other thing too, this really kind of troubles me too, is a lot of these people are going to get slightly more than slap on the wrist for this. In the old days, you would have been hung. Every single last one of you would have been taken out and you would have been hung. Or a firing squad or something else appropriate for the time.
But these guys will do 10 years. Many of them, correct.
There will be some of that, but I think the lion's share of them. So for example, if I never turned my phone on in the Capitol, I'm not getting busted unless someone turns me in.
Yeah.
Right? You think about it. I mean, there's more people will get away with it than they ever. Right now, it's around 200 or 300. It's just.
But still, that's how many it was.
Yeah.
You know, it was just to see it all unfold.
It was crazy, Dave. Like, crazy.
And the thing is, I mean, I'm kind of glad I don't have to talk about these guys for a while. You know,
that's another thing that's been great since the inauguration of the new president. The idea that Trump has become more and more minimized, and he doesn't have that. What Twitter did was brilliant. You basically cut the head off the snake.
Yeah.
By them silencing him, they can talk about all these platforms and the Trump News Network and all that stuff. They'll all fail. You're never going to be the behemoth of Twitter. And if Twitter will never allow you back on, you are going to be silenced. That's the bottom line.
Because he's nothing if he can't provoke anger.
And lie and misrepresent.
Yeah. All right. So.
Yeah. And I know. We do the whole show. But before we go into around the league, I just want to talk about loss for a second, because the last time we had, had spoken, I don't think either one of us had known anybody personally that had died of COVID. Had you by that, by the end of November? Because I did. I had a
relative in Italy, kind of a great aunt pass.
Okay.
So, that's about as far. And then my brother-in-law had it, and everybody in his house had it. you know.
So we did talk about that. So that all resolved itself?
That all resolved itself. Everybody's fine.
Good. That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. So I knew that as the days went on, the odds would be that we would start to know people that died of COVID. And the fact is, you know, it's happened to me a couple of times now. A friend of mine's wife that I went, one of the gyms, one of the auxiliary lady gyms, passed away in December, partly due to COVID. And then my first wife, Carrie LaRue.
Carrie LaRue. Died.
In part due to COVID. She had a muscular disorder, but her death was escalated by COVID. And my brother is struggling with it mightily right now. And he's had it for probably 3.5 weeks. And my whole point is that I think COVID really starts to hit home on this other kind of level when it hits you personally, when you are, you know, until you know someone that gets it and dies from it, you're just a casual mourner like everybody else.
No, and it's very sad. It's devastating. And I'm glad we have a president who is going to rationally try to deal with it.
Correct.
But enough said on current events. Let's get to current events within baseball. And
right.
I got to tell you, my heart is very heavy. Tom and I are wearing black armbands as the tallest tree in the forest that is the Hall of Fame has passed. And I'm talking about Henry Aaron. And this is a man who, when he retired, was the career leader in home runs. Mm-hmm. He was the career leader in RBIs, the all-time leader in those two categories, the all-time leader in total bases. Yeah. And he was third all-time in hits. Okay. And, you know, it really hits me. I went to Mobile, Alabama looking for Henry Aaron. And I found his child at home. Yeah. That had been taken off of its foundation and moved to the parking lot of the Mobile Bay Bears,
right,
which is a minor league team that was part of the Arizona Diamondbacks, you know, farm system, and they were closing. It was going to be their last year, and the house is a museum. And I went in, and you know, I just can't help feeling this tremendous sense of grief.
Right.
You know, we lost Joe Morgan this year,
right,
and I was a Reds fan, and he was my favorite player.
Right.
This is worse.
Yeah.
This is worse.
Well, we lost an all-star team of Hall of Famers in the last year. And we've covered off on all of those with the exception of, I think, of Sutton and Lasorda. I think maybe one other person another Hall of Famer died maybe in December that we missed. But the point is, this is the biggest one, and you're right. He's the tallest tree. He's the redwood tree. He's hard to miss.
He is.
And an absolute titan giant of the game. There's no, there really is no baseball without Henry Aaron. And oh, by the way, while most people know him as Hank Aaron, he hated that.
He hated it.
And, you know, begrudgingly accepted it because that's kind of how he was known.
That's what you do, yeah.
But if you were his friend, you called him Henry. And the tragedy of a Henry Aaron is that unlike Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson's personality was different than Henry Aaron. Henry Aaron, you know, was a very quiet guy. He never really, you know, what he did focus on was the pitcher. And they always said that he, every day, that's the whole time he would be sitting there, he'd be thinking about who that pitcher was on the mound. He didn't really play into all this other stuff. But when you look, there's a couple of things that stand out when you talk about Henry Aaron. The biggest thing to me is the racism that he had to endure, particularly when he got close to breaking Babe Ruth's record.
He never asked for any of that.
Yeah, and he, by the way, that end of his career, he hated the most because of all of the, obviously getting all these letters, and he had to have bodyguards and all of this stuff. But the thing that crushed him was that even in Atlanta, the fans, even in Atlanta,
in his
where he played, where he did so much for that town, still fell along racial lines. And the good old white boys still gave him unbelievable amounts of hell and kind of soured him on the game of baseball towards the end of his career. Fortunately, he's, you know, being the great man that he is, he was able to get past this. But there was this period of time where the great Henry Aaron didn't like the game of baseball at all.
No, he didn't like it at all. And I'll tell you something else, though. It was here in Chicago where his faith was restored.
Right,
Because Jesse Jackson would arrange with Operation Push to bring a busload of kids from the South Side
to
greet Aaron at O'Hare. Right. And then also when he played at Wrigley, when he was getting close, the one place where the fans appreciated him and applauded him.
Correct.
He's nearing this great landmark, you know, and they came out to see him. Well, like they didn't come out to see him in Atlanta.
But
he always said that Chicago really kind of helped him get through it. So I'm glad about that.
Again, another Union City.
Another Union City. Yeah. Exactly. You know, but Henry Aaron is the last Negro leaguer to play in the major leagues.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. He's the last player in the major leagues who also played in the Negro leagues. And that's significant this year because Negro League stats are now being added to career stats.
Right. But before you get to that though, Leo, I just want to say one last thing about Henry Aaron's stats, because it's worth noting because you kind of referenced it, but he's the only, I tried to look this up over the week to see if I could find another player. Maybe you can. He is the only player that I'm aware of that was a slugger, that if you subtract his home run total from his hit total, he still has 3,000 hits. Okay, so that's how my mind, I think about stuff like that.
He's not quite. He's just short of 3,000.
No, he's not. He had 3,771 hits, and he hit 755 home runs. So it's not. It actually is.
Yeah, you're right.
And so here's the other thing, this the kind of anomaly. You touched on it. But don't discount the value of the fact that he has the most total bases in Major League history, 6,856.
Has the most.
Which is 600 more than Stan Musial that in second place. So that is a significant thing. And then the one last thing, the thing we used to say in the bars back in the 90s, if you hit 35 home runs for 20 years, you'd be 55 short.
Wow. Yeah. But the thing is, and we're talking about, of course, his career record officially of 755. But the reason why, and we're going to talk about the Negro League stats later in their sort of entirety.
Yeah.
But if you look at the stats that they're going to count from when he was in the Negro Leagues,
right,
he did an additional 5 home runs. So that puts his career total, I think it's 6. That puts his career total at 781, which is still short of Bonds.
761.
761, which is still like 2 short of Bonds.
Correct.
Because immediately when I thought of that,
short of Bonds. One short of Bonds.
All right. We might need to get the official totals. And I'm remembering what I read.
He's very close. The point is, you're right. He's very close.
But he's just short. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wonder the impact of that. You know, that we have to talk about the Negro League stats because you're absolutely right. But one last thing as we segue into our next topic is that 143 win above replacement.
That's you know, he was the one hitter who Bob Gibson feared.
Correct.
Correct. Clemente and Aaron.
Which is interesting because Gibson did not fear many right-handed hitters at all. In fact, he disrespected right-handed hitters, in all honesty. The left-handed hitters were because he was obviously a right-handed power pitcher. But anyways, we could talk the whole day about Henry Aaron, and we're going to miss him. I think he's one of baseball's top 5 players, and I don't say that loosely.
No, and our next topic really is just another – gee whiz, we're just going to have to do another obituary because we have to talk about Hall of Famers Don Sutton and Tommy Lasorda. And, you know, Sutton had a great career, but I'm going to tell you, Tommy Lasorda also hurt me. I hated Lasorda back when the Dodgers were the Dodgers and it was the 80s and he was their manager. But, man, I learned to love that guy. You know, I'm sorry.
You know, the interesting thing as a manager, he had a pretty steady hand in the yeah. dugout. He was not like Billy Martin. He was not, you know, he was more of a conservative manager in his approach to the game. He was about acquiring good players and letting them play. You know,
and
kind
he was
of the
about
old...
keeping them. He was about keeping them loose, getting them talking. Yeah. You know what I mean? He was in their ear. And
right.
He was good like that. You know.
Yeah.
And he knew how to handle pitching. Now he's managing half his games at Dodger Stadium, where the pitching, you know, you have a tremendous advantage. But he knew what he was doing. I always felt as a manager, he had one great blunder. I remember in the 1985 playoffs, where he allows Tom Niedenfuhr to pitch to Jack Clark in the playoffs.
Yeah. Big mistake.
Clark, you know, Clark was having a tremendous year. I just remember the ball going over the fence. Pedro Guerrero slamming the glove down.
Well, there was no doubt about that home run. I remember that home run very vividly. Yeah. You know, if you want to capture the essence of Tommy Lasorda, go onto YouTube and watch the video of him attacking the mascot of the Philadelphia Phillies.
Oh,
an exhibition game.
I probably saw this on This Week in Baseball.
Yeah. Exactly. So he was just a great Italian American, a great Dodger, a huge loss. And Don Sutton as well. I mean, Don Sutton had a fair amount of wins as a pitcher, and both Hall of Famers.
There's a great, I'm going to tell one Lasorda story. I'll get through it quick, but basically, when he was a kid, he got a job as a crossing guard because the way they'd pay him is they'd give him, you know, tickets to the ball game. And he got to go to the Polo Grounds to see the Giants play. And after the game, you know, they're on the field and the players are out there and they're coming up towards the tunnel up that little hill, Coogan's Bluff, you know, towards the locker rooms. And he stands in front of the first major league player he's ever seen. He says, "Can I get an autograph, mister?" And the guy just says, "Get out of my way, kid." And he pushes him aside. Fast forward. Now Lasorda is a prospect for the Dodgers in the Sally League. And up to the plate comes Buster Maynard, the same guy. And Lasorda throws right at his head.
Nice.
And starts a huge fight. And then Maynard comes into the locker room at the end of the game. And he's like, "Kid, hey, what did I ever do to you?" He's like, You didn't give me your autograph when I was a kid. So, and he would tell that story a lot. And that's one of my favorites.
So he held grudges just like the Irish people do.
I know. So, all right. So now we mentioned this in the Hank Aaron discussion. I'm sorry, the Henry Aaron discussion. And that the Negro League stats are going to be made official. They're going to be made part of the official record of Stats Incorporated and Baseball Reference. And all these things are going to integrate, we hope, in some seamless way, in some form of seamless way, into the body of major league stats. So you're going to see career totals change for a lot of guys who, you know, came in
correct
at that time. And I think this is long overdue. And I think that this is also an indication of what is just how insidious a thing racism is, because it forces you to call into question what you can call official.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. You know, it questions everything. You want to be official. You want to be the official record of the history of the game. Well, that is now all called into question because of your inability to allow people to play based on their abilities, you know, based on their talent.
Yeah. Or based on the color of their skin more.
Based on the color. Yes.
So it's interesting because I think you're going to see 10 to 15 of the Negro League stars move right up to the top of the major league stat categories in regards to like win above replacement stuff.
Right.
So for example, Satchel Paige, I don't know how they're going to kind of adjudicate his career, but it would be Cy Young in the sense that he pitched sometimes 3-4 times a week.
Yeah.
And with no issue on his arm whatsoever. And he was, you know, he's a hard throwing pitcher. So there's, whoever is responsible for whatever company is responsible for converting and updating those stats, my hat's off to you, because it's going to be difficult for you to be completely accurate. The idea that you're trying is a great step. You know, it's just,
no, you're right. And the fact that it is murky is what is so evil about racism. And you're right, though. Page's numbers will be completely, he'll go from, you know, he's a 17 win above replacement right now, and he's going to go to like 180. You know what I mean? He's
No. He will not eclipse Ruth because I don't know. The reason why Ruth is so high is because he was a hitter and a pitcher.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's unlikely, but it's not unlikely to think that it could be north of 140. I'm kind of a student of the win above replacements. And for you to break 140, you're in the top 10 players that ever lived.
Yeah.
And so, well, guess what? They got Charleston. He's going to be way up there.
Yeah.
They
Charleston will be. Yeah. Yeah.
And what's his name? What's the great catcher?
Josh Gibson.
Josh Gibson will have over 500 home runs. So, there's a lot of things that kind of have to play out, but I think it's encouraging that they're doing this. Some people think it's crazy. It's crazy that it's not been. And like you said,
it's crazy that we haven't done this.
We're going to talk about, you know, sexism and racism coming up in the next few topics, but it just seems like it permeates throughout baseball. Baseball likes to talk about how well they're doing, but in reality, it's more of what I would call a tokenization that occurs. It's not a it's not enduring change that reflects society.
It's ridiculous that it took them this long to do it, but it's also ridiculous that it had to be done.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
And speaking of which, the Miami Marlins have just named the very first female general manager. Her name is Kim Ninge. Mm-hmm. Kim Ninge. And she's not a novice. She's been in the game of baseball for over 20 years. And so I just think that it's interesting that the Marlins they're the Cleveland Indians, because the Cleveland Indians are the first one to have a black manager when they hired Frank Robinson in 75. And now she's the first female GM in history. I think this is great. I wish her well. However, I would say, hey, Kim, you do understand that you have the Miami Marlins.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're set up to fail. I hate to say it.
Well, you know what? Tom? I just became a Miami Marlins fan. If I'm going to root for somebody in the National League East, I'll root for them because I want to see her succeed.
Correct. And
I would love to see her succeed in working for, you know, taking an organization that really is a bit of a bottom feeder and turning them into something special. So
root for Miami. I'm going to root for Washington, or as I like to call them, Cubs East.
Cubs East, exactly. With Martinez and John Lester. But you know, it's interesting, as the Marlins hire a general manager, the Mets fire a general manager. And what's wonderful about what the Mets did is that they did the same thing that they did with their manager, Carlos Beltran,
about
a year earlier when they hired him and had to fire him 3 months later. You know, because of his role in the cheating scandal. This guy, Jared Porter, used to work for the Cubs.
He did.
Hired him as their general manager, and then they had to fire him because he likes taking pictures of his cock.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is, he sent 60 unanswered texts to a female. 60. So when I first heard that, I thought to myself, okay,
60.
She must have done something to you that you thought that there was some kind of big, you know, love connection here that obviously didn't exist in his mind. That's what happened. But 60 texts, I have to say, have you ever done that? Ever? Have you ever done that with anybody about anything?
Done that to anybody. I've never. How could you do that to somebody? How can you not get the message that you're bothering this person?
Right.
I mean, but I don't know. And the thing is, and the other thing too, is that they're like, well, we did our due diligence. We'd asked all these people to attest to his character. They all
asked Cubs people. Well, they're turning out not to be reliable.
Well, it's not that. No, it's the fact that the question is not how many people they asked who said he was good. They didn't ask any women. How many women did you ask?
Yeah, feel that he's kind of creepy.
And the 60 text messages, the unanswered text messages, including all the – that's just what we know about. How many has he done to women who haven't come forward?
Correct.
And how do the Cubs not know this? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. It's the whole thing is unsavory. And I just, I'm embarrassed about the Cubs. It's another situation. And we're going to talk about some other things when we talk about the Cubs that even embarrass me more. Yeah. But I think that this is, you know, it's
awful. It's awful. And
baseball doesn't do a very good job vetting, number one. And number two, why was he even considered if you guys are going to be so pro, you know, hiring diversity, people of color, women, and then you hired a good old white boy from Chicago? I mean, seriously, it's like, it's just something about this whole thing just reeks.
Well, it is distasteful, to say the least. And I think that this is a black mark
on
Theo Epstein. I thought that Theo did a good job dealing with the domestic violence as it related to Addison Russell. But this time, he was, Hoyer, him, this is disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. And you're right, because there's no way he didn't know about some of this stuff. Whether he had the sense that this was doing it or he had actual evidence, there's no way he didn't know.
So let's talk about another culturally insensitive nickname that is about to be done away with. The Cleveland Indians have announced that they're going to change their name.
Yeah.
And this is a long time coming as well. And there are a lot of candidates for the new name. I'm sure, you know, you have your opinion on who you like. But I think overall, I also support this decision.
Yeah, you know, and I read, Poznanski's article in The Athletic about, you know, he's a longtime Cleveland's fan. He completely agrees with any logical person would say, how the hell did this last so long? I mean, think about it from there. But Joe looks at it from a different perspective. He looks at it from a perspective that, hey, we get to change our team, our colors. It's all new things get to happen. Like maybe all the teams in baseball should change their names. At one point, he kind of poses that rhetorically. And, you know, first of all, you're never going to get the Yankees to change their name. But maybe that's not such a bad idea. I started thinking along those lines. And then, you know, and another thing that I loved about Joe's article is that he correctly points out the atrocious John Fogerty center field anthem, and I completely agree with that. So they kind of started talking about, you know, what are the names. People are talking about Cleveland Spiders, Cleveland Rocks.
Cleveland Rocks, that's what I like.
I kind of like that one too, because it rhymes with what I used to say when I would watch Cleveland play as a Tiger fan. Cleveland sucks. This is kind of exciting. Some people are, you know, your traditionalists, the people that don't like change are never going to be happy with this, but it's disgusting. It's not unlike what happened with the Washington football team. This is disgusting. And again, one of the few times we called it right, you and I called, when I listen to some of our old shows, which I do occasionally when I'm walking the dude, you know, a lot of times I'm like, I can't believe how wrong we were. I mean, literally we are wrong a lot, which is good.
Which is good.
But occasionally we're right, and we were completely right about this.
That is funny.
And meaning that the Atlanta Braves is different than the Cleveland Indians, and that was kind of the discussion we had.
The only problem with the Cleveland Rocks or the Rockers is that we have the Rockies, but I guess, you know.
Yeah, you know what? You know what? I never thought about that. That almost disqualifies it. You're gonna have to go to the Guardians.
Yeah.
Or no, here's the one that I liked: the Buckeyes, in homage to their Negro Leagues team.
Okay. All right. That actually, because when you said Buckeyes, you know.
Again, and it rhymes with another chant that I give the Cleveland team. So I'm happy. The outsiders like it. The insiders like it.
I didn't realize that was the Negro League team. I would have not liked Buckeyes, but the fact that they were the Negro League team, I think that's actually a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, pitchers and cheating. I shared with you an article earlier this winter about how pitchers, you know, we've been bitterly critical about the way that the Houston Astros cheated, you know, their way to winning a World Series. And the way that they're banging on garbage cans and getting all sorts of extra help. And pitchers really are doing the same thing, Tom. Pitchers are using illegal substances. They're rubbing them on the ball.
Right.
Spitball is an antiquated notion. There are all sorts of just crazy things that increase the ability to hold or touch the baseball to put more spin on it and spin, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is what they're after, you know, and what can be done about this? Because from what I understand, according to people like Trevor Bauer, everybody does it.
Yeah. You know, it takes me back to, I was fortunate enough to go to a couple of the games of the 2006 World Series when Detroit lost to St. Louis.
Yeah.
And one of the games was a Sunday night game where Kenny Rogers, the Detroit pitcher, was pitching. And we were at the game and I didn't think anything of it. Meanwhile, national on television, everyone is like, what is that substance on Kenny Rogers' hand? And then they put a picture on it, and he's got this pine tar wrapped all around his thumb. And then, you know, they call the umpire. And I remember watching the game going, hey, I didn't even notice any of that stuff going on. But if you were watching the game on TV, they were really focusing in on the whole pine tar on the hand thing. It lasted for a couple of days. And then basically clubhouse guys were coming out and saying all of the baseballs are, you know, rubbed with pine tar every game. I mean, that's a standard thing. They've been, you know, adding adhesives, if you will, to the baseball, which changes how it acts when it's been thrown. And they claim that it gives the pitchers an advantage, which it does, except for one thing. We're living in an offensive era. We're not living in a pitching era. And granted, the strikeouts are tremendous, no doubt about it, but that's only because the hitters are trying to hit home runs every time.
I challenge that assumption that we're in a hitter's era. I mean,
well, it's not a dead ball pitching era that
no,
would make
it's
you
not.
Think.
It's not. It's not. But strikeouts are going up. Strikeouts are an indication that
right.
pitchers are having success.
No doubt. But it's also an indication that the guy is lifting the swing up to try to hit a home run. We're not seeing, you and I've covered this in the past, we're not seeing hitters like Rod Carew and George Brett that would hit to every single field, or like Henry Aaron, who hit to every single field. You're not seeing that. You're seeing the one true outcome. So that kind of really murks up this discussion. It all comes back to, do they need to create a baseball that would have its own adhesive on it that's uniform across the game? That's basically what the article was suggesting.
Right.
They're investigating.
Yeah.
And then some hitters have said, yeah, they've tried to do that. And every time we get those baseballs, those balls do not hit the same way that the other. So it's a gigantic quagmire that baseball is in.
Big problem. It is.
But I think they need to do something so that there's consistency. Because when people start to say, well, they're coming up with these magic potions to put on the ball, they've been doing that for 50, 60 years. This is, you know, maybe even longer than that.
Goes back to
maybe even 80 years. It's just.
And longer. Correct. That's all guys did. Yeah, that's all guys did. That's how, yeah. So, no, but it is it's a fascinating subject. And we've been critical, you and I.
Yeah.
Of cheating. And you know, I think that this is something that they do have to codify, you know, and we'll look forward to that. Now, the other issue, too, is the DH, the universal DH, is still not a done deal. Again, I really hope that starting pitchers still continue to hit. It is the best form of the game, and changing it or making it a universal DH changes the way we consume the sport. It's not a good idea here, I'm telling you. So I don't know what you think. Ultimately, maybe your mind has finally been changed. I mean, we had a universal DH this year. I don't think it made the game particularly better. I still watched it, but I prefer to have the pitchers hit.
I do too. There would, in my world, there would be like 10 things and seven of them I can't say here on this podcast. But one of those things would be that there would be no DH. That would be one of my executive orders on day one. No more DH. I don't care what you say. I don't want to see it anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, and so that's not going to happen. And so if the DH is inevitable to keep baseball going, I will begrudgingly agree with the caveat that article proposes, which they're talking about the DH as the DH 2.0 or the double hook, meaning that if the new caveat to the DH, which I love, by the way, some people hate it, but I love it, and I'll tell you why. And that basically for our listener out there, what they're suggesting is that when the starting pitcher is removed from a game, that also removes the DH from the game.
Right, right. Which is nonsense. I got to tell you right now.
I disagree because it's more strategy. If you're going to have the DH, then there's strategy.
Listen, Tom, you need to seek help right now.
So yeah. Then get rid of the DH. Of the DH.
No. And I'm kidding. I mean, I don't disagree with you like that. But I do say that earlier I have proposed kind of the inverse of that, in that you start with nine men batting, a nine-man lineup with the pitcher hitting. And then when the starting pitcher is removed, that's when you get your DH.
Yeah, well, the problem is that one of the parties in baseball dismissed that idea. That's been proposed before, and because that does make sense. Yeah. But baseball put the kibosh on that, so that's not going to happen. So that's why we're in this. It's a quagmire. The whole thing is just.
I'm so sorry that they dismissed that outright, because that's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Because when you really think about it, starting pitchers don't bat more than once or twice a game, you know? And if a starting pitcher bats three times in a game, that means he's successful.
Yeah.
That means he's shutting him out.
Right.
So, you know, it's not I don't think it would be a big deal. You know, then you just put in your DH and you can pinch hit for your DH. It doesn't really change the game ultimately. And then I would even be willing to go so far as to say for playoff games, you could add a DH.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Then, but for the regular season, it matters because when pitchers hit, the game is more interesting for the players.
Hey, you're preaching to the choir, brother. We've hashed this out many times.
And you're right.
I think we're basically on the same page. The only reason why I like the double hook is because it adds another thing for the manager to do. That's it. That's the only reason why.
And theoretically, I
like that.
But
if you're going to have this stupid rule.
What I don't think is you'll get the outcomes you intended.
No doubt. And the other thing that baseball needs to consider when they make these stupid changes all the time, why don't you put a rule that automatically says this will be tested for one season, then reevaluated? That's what they should do with all of these things.
No, you're right. You're right.
Let's get the data we need and we can make a decision.
But don't make it feel like it's just forever. Now, we have a topic listed here about the free agent tracker. Is there anybody you wanted to mention?
Yeah, I do. I want to talk about the fact that there's been some big signings. Obviously, we all know what those are. But I think it's just kind of interesting that there's, you know, four or five players out there right now that are still available that are big free agents, one of which I wish the Cubs would take a look at. And that's, to me, the guy that's at the top of the board. And that's Marcell Ozuna. Many people think it's Trevor Bauer, who's still a free agent. I think it's Ozuna. And I wish that he would fit so beautifully in the Cubs outfield, fit so beautifully in anybody's outfield. But I
mean, yeah, that would be fun to have him at Wrigley for a full, you know, if he could play 81 games at Wrigley. That could be really exciting.
And then you've got Civil War hero Nelson Cruz. How old is he now? I mean, he's like got to be one of the oldest guys in baseball.
Please don't. I want the Cubs to be – if the Cubs are going to lose, I want them to lose because they're young. I don't want Moses to play for the Cubs.
But what do you think about – not? And I'm not thinking about this in terms of the Cubs so much, is that these as free agents, like – just one last thing about Trevor Bauer. Is it possible that Trevor Bauer hasn't signed? It's not just about financials. It could be that people just don't like the guy.
I think he's kind of gotten past that a little bit. And the fact that he finished second in Cy Young voting, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Look,
there aren't a lot of GMs going, oh, you know, I don't want that guy. No, what they're saying is, I don't know if I can afford that guy.
Or we're going to have to hire a guy to be his bodyguard type of thing.
Hey, look.
Life coach.
He very easily could have won the Cy Young Award. Or he did win the Cy Young Award.
He did win the Cy Young Award. He seems like he should have been in second place, but no, he actually did win it.
That's right. He actually did. He was the first Cincinnati Red to ever win a Cy Young Award.
And I like to say our for this year, it's peanuts and popcorn, where accuracy is a word.
Accuracy. Accuracy is accuracy. That's correct, Tom. Accuracy is a word.
Accuracy now, is a word.
Now we're gonna go to Chicago baseball now. Yeah. And ordinarily on Peanuts and Popcorn we would do a Cubs segment here, but now we've decided that we're gonna merge it into one thing because the White Sox are really interesting right now. And yeah. You know, I wouldn't call the White Sox my favorite team, but I want them to win. They're certainly my favorite American League team. You know, and the Cubs, a little of the luster is sort of worn off. I mean, we'll be talking about them, but sort of in more objective terms.
My opinion is just like yours, only it's the exact opposite.
Exactly. All right. So now the White Sox are getting busy.
Yeah.
And they have acquired.
Well, when I first heard that they signed Hendricks, yeah. I was like, yeah. Oh, no. The Cubs, are you kidding me? Yeah, well, what right. else have you given away? Say, yeah, but, oh, Liam Hendricks. Okay.
And what's funny about Hendricks is that his nickname is Slider. Slider, because that's his big pitch. Yeah, and now he's going to be the South Slider. Yeah. You know, he's the
I'll
South.
I'll be turning the volume down when they start talking like that.
Yeah. But I think that he makes the White Sox better today.
Yeah, he's no doubt
good. And you know what's interesting about Hendricks is that he has a Luke Longley connection. That Luke Longley, who was the starting center for the Bulls,
right,
won three in a row, the second three-peat. Longley's from the same town in Australia as Hendricks.
Right. Wow.
And I heard an interview with Hendricks, and when he was getting offers to come to the United States to play either in the minor leagues or to play at different colleges, he asked Luke what he thought he should do. And Luke said, well, what are the colleges that are reaching out to you? He's like, well, you know, they're Division III schools. One's in Western South Dakota. And Luke's like, go to the minors, dude.
Right, yeah. Right.
Go right to the minors. So that was kind of.
Thank you, Luke, for that fatherly advice.
Now, I really want to see the White Sox succeed, but I was also, you know, and you, I believe, were right there with me. We were critical that they had hired Tony La Russa to be their manager.
Who's in between drunk driving incidences as we speak.
Exactly. Who, you know, they hire him and it was a Carlos Beltran. Yeah. You know, they hire him and they said that they knew that he'd had this drunk driving charge and it was dismissed. So yeah. I'm glad that's all sorted out, right, Tom?
Yeah, of course, course. Our country must be like a banana republic when you can pull this stuff off. If this was me or you, we'd be out a couple thousand dollars and, we'd be social pariahs. Well, we kind of are anyways because of COVID. But the point is that I thought that was weird because the Sox knew about that arrest.
Yeah, they did know about it.
I personally, we've talked about this. I wish him well. I imagine at some point that baseball is going to have to start putting ads on their uniforms and starting wearing logos. And yeah. I can see La Russa right there, Geritol.
Yeah,
Tony La Russa, Geritol.
Okay, now come on, Tom. That's going to be us. That's going to be us one day. You know what I mean? Yeah. But you're right. It would be wonderful to see that. It better happen this year if it's going to happen. All I'm going to say. So, but as the Tony La Russa era begins on the South Side or recommences on the South Side, the Theo Epstein era on the North Side came to an end. Yeah. And after one world championship, two NLCS appearances, and four division titles, has Theo Epstein left the Cubs in better shape than he found them?
That is a really good question. That may be the best baseball question of the week because you could make a case for yes, he has, or no, he hasn't. The earth has been scorched again. So when I look at it, Theo, have nothing but fond memories. I mean, you got us a World Series, yeah. but when you kind of look at it from a total standpoint, it was less than the desired results. I mean, I just think that we could A, be in a better position that we're in now, and B, we could have had more success at the core of 2016. When in 2015, where you remember we were knocking on the door at the end of 2015. Right. 2016, clear best team in baseball, I thought. As good as the Indians were, I thought the Cubs throughout the regular season were just a dynamo team. You would expect that 2017 would have been a season that would have been similar to that, or whatever the shortcomings were,
They did go to the NLCS, you know.
They did, but they always were just a little bit less than they were the year before. They just started to run out of gas, and Epstein did not properly anticipate that, nor address and try to resolve it. To his credit, he could sit here and say, "Well, you're right, because I had $1.8 million left to spend." Or whatever. We had nothing else that we could do financially. He could give me that reason, and there could be a legitimate reason. But it just seems to me that,
well,
your job is to win and to figure out how to put those pieces together. Billy Beane pretty much taught baseball that it could be done. It could be done in a multitude of ways. Last year, Tampa Bay showed baseball. It could be done in a multitude of ways. I think that while Theo was baseball's hot commodity, hot young thing in 2007 and so forth, when he was on Boston, the tarnish started to wear off a little bit as he finished his tenure in Chicago.
Well, when I think of Theo Epstein, though, I'm going to remember a guy, you know, who was objective and accessible and honest and transparent. And, you know, he thought about the decisions he made. And that's really all, you know, that's all I can ask for is a fan. You know, they were a little unlucky, you know, whereas in 2016, every decision worked out. You know, the percentage of decisions that worked out after that really, really went downhill. You know, I mean, caught up with him big time.
Yeah.
He tried to address problems and they never got the outcomes that they wanted, you know.
So, I mean, it's the Cubs, obviously, we're going to be making wholesale changes to the team.
And they did,
they need to get a GM, because everyone, it seems like it's just like in the air traffic controllers, when you make a mistake, you get promoted. And that's what's happened here. All these guys move up a slot, which opens up the GM position.
They're not going to have a GM until fans are allowed back in the stadium.
But here's my thought. They don't need a GM because all they're doing is giving rid of their players. Anybody can do that. They're not bringing anybody on. So you don't need a GM. All you're doing, you've gotten rid of Yu Darvish. I mean, Yu Darvish is a great pitcher. Now, granted, this would have been a really brilliant trade if you didn't get three junk pieces from the Padres. I read the analysis and they said, we got fleeced on that trade. And again, maybe one of these guys will become an all-star. It's unlikely based on what I read, but fingers crossed, I'm optimistic. And also, you was old. You was 35. That's old for pitchers.
You was 35?
No. Yeah. I had read that he was like 35, and I'm like, you know what? There's some thinking there. And you know, then they let Quintana go. Quintana, you know, you can say what you want about Quintana, but if he's healthy, he's an 8-10 win pitcher. You don't have a lot of those guys. That's just my opinion. The other guys I'm okay with. As sad as it is to see Schwarber head over to Washington, at least I can root for Washington now. And Schwarber, here's my thought. You would never not be signed by any team if you could bat more than 180 or 190 in the major leagues. That's the problem. Everything else, you've done a great job to become a fair to middling left fielder. And I give you credit for that, because when you started, you were the worst left fielder. So,
the worst is the guy who plays for the White Sox, who the Cubs traded away to get Quintana.
Yeah, correct. I don't even want to think about that. That makes me mental.
I'm sorry. He's a great hitter, but he's an awful, awful left fielder. And his name escapes me. You're
talking about Eloy Jimenez, who plays next to the five-tool Luis Robert. Robert. His name is Robert. This year is Robert.
But any Latin American talking to Luis Robert is going to say it like that.
Anyways, we gave up Tyler Chatwood. And as you accurately point out in the show sheet, our rotation today, and it's formidable, is Kyle Hendricks and Alan Mills.
Wow. Yeah. Kyle Hendricks and Kyle Hendricks light.
Right. The guy that threw a no-hitter and every other game has been a disaster. No, just kidding. I kid.
But you know what?
You don't need a GM when you're just getting rid of everybody. I think an administrator could do that job.
Or you're just sort of unloading salary. And that's really the big thing with the Cubs right now, because the Cubs really aren't going to be competitive for these big free agents.
Go get Ozuna. You have the money now. Go get Ozuna. Go get Trevor Bauer. Show the fans that you at least kind of want to be, because this team will be in last place.
I don't know about that. The National League Central is a strange place to live.
Yeah,
and
it is.
Anything can happen. These teams are kind of all about the same level. And I don't think the Cubs will really flex their financial muscles until baseball gets back to normal, because then they're really making bank. You know what I mean? Then they're selling tickets. Then they're selling concessions. Then they're selling luxury boxes and hotel rooms and all of that stuff.
So you're talking about 2024?
Yeah, 2024. When all that gets back to normal, then you'll see the Cubs go back to being the Cubs. But until then, expect kind of a lesser product. And that's where you as a fan, I think, have to be, or not you particularly, Tom, but just collectively.
Thanks for clearing that up.
But collectively, fans have to be, they have to learn to find interesting things about a team that isn't in first place. Right. You know, maybe a player's having a good year. Maybe that player might get traded to get you prospects that might get you to the World Series or whatever. I mean, it's these little things. It's the building the team back up, the climbing of the mountain, starting from the bottom. You know what I mean? And that's, I think, for me, what I'm going to enjoy watching.
You know, before we get to our movie section, I just want to kind of reference The Shawshank Redemption. There's a big principle in this film where they talk about hope. And I think that hope, when it comes to being a baseball fan, is a very dangerous thing. And particularly if you're, you know, fortunately for me and for you, you know, we follow other teams besides just the Cubs, but we're basically Cubs fans
at the end of the day.
I hate to say the end of the day, we talked about this already, but we're, you know, we're dyed-in-the-wool Cubs fans. And so when you know you're basically being fed shit from the management team as far as what the 2021 season is going to be, when you get rid of half of your team, and except for that sterling rotation of Hendricks and Mills, we have no hope, is what I'm saying. We have no hope.
Yeah, you
all hope is lost.
That's not true.
This is a Titanic situation.
That's not true. No, I'm not unrealistic. I'm not saying that the Cubs are gonna go out and win the 2021 World Series. But I do think that they'll be able to put a product on the field that will be interesting for me to watch, because I am a baseball junkie. And the good thing is that tickets will be easy to get.
That's true.
Maybe my wife and I will buy season tickets.
Well, so you know,
good. You know, this is when you have to strike where the iron is hot.
I'll give you something positive, is that they are keeping, at least through the trade deadline, Contreras, Baez, and Bryant.
Right.
And so that's encouraging.
Baez is only the most electrifying player, you know, in baseball.
I think you can make a case where you need all three of those guys.
And let's not forget about Jason Hayward.
Yeah,
this is the guy we're paying $25 million to. He once had a 7 WAR wins above replacement season.
I know. You know what I mean? I can remember back in those days, barely. But yes, I do remember.
But I mean, I'm not saying that he's going to go out and have a great year. However, I've seen stranger things happen.
Yeah, right. And he's still an able-bodied defender. So, enough baseball. Enough of the peanuts. It's time for popcorn.
It is time for popcorn. And I got to choose the movie this week. And I chose Death to 2020. And we saw it because we can't go to movie theaters.
Yeah.
I saw it at home with my wife on New Year's Eve. And this is basically written by Charlie Brooker.
Right.
This is the man who's behind the series Black Mirror, if you're familiar with that. He's also been doing satire and comedy for a program or a slot called Newswipe. And he's very smart and he's very funny. And what he basically does is he does a kind of a a mockumentary, or he sort of creates a fake interview show where he interviews people, famous people, playing different characters. Right. So you have Samuel L. Jackson, you have Hugh Grant, you have Leslie, the woman from Saturday Night Live, Leslie Jones, who's very funny. You have all these people playing characters, talking about all the things, the awful things that happened during 2020. And Leslie Jones' character has a great line. She says, "I would call it a shit show and a train wreck, but that would be unfair to shit and trains," which I thought was a brilliant line. And I got to tell you, Tom, it crushed us. We were watching this with my sister-in-law, and we were crying, holding our sides laughing. If you have not seen this, you've got to see it. One of the funniest things I've seen in 20 years. Do you agree?
Basically I do. I give this film 3.5 stars. I have to say, I went into it apprehensive, thinking, you know, we're talking about the classics and here's your first choice and you pick Death to 2020. That's so Leo Fontana of you. But yeah. then I watched the film and a couple of things stood out. I understand that they were in kind of a calendar of talking about 2020. They started in January, went through the whole year. I thought that they basically stopped filming on December 23rd, that if they would have waited 2 more weeks until the insurrection at the Capitol, you would have a Citizen Kane on your hands. And so I would almost say to Charlie, go back in and recut the film.
Cut it.
Because if you add that element, that's where the film, it started to drag a little bit towards the end. And it was only, they were a victim of the way that they set up the pacing of the film itself, and that came back to bite them, because towards the end it became kind of anticlimactic, and I think that you would have seen a completely different and better film if you added the irony of the insurrection. But that
six more days.
But I thought that it was the Larry Fishburne played the announcer, and he crushed me a couple of times.
Which one? The
Lawrence Fishburne. He played the narrator.
The narrator. That's right.
And the narrator consistently. I already used my favorite line. He was talking about Joe Biden, and he said, "Civil War hero Joe Biden."
You know who my favorite was?
That made me take a knee. I mean, that doesn't happen very often, but I laughed literally out loud at a couple of times, and he was referring to other things, and everything he said, it was almost like a rich base. Guy was doing W.C. Fields, because he was making little asides throughout all of his pronunciations of the different events of the year. I thought it was a splendid film. And, how does it get categorized? What is that film? One last thing, and I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up. And this is a biggie. And in the film, the person that stole the film, there was this character called Kathy Flowers, played by Kristen Milioti. I don't know if you're familiar with the actress.
The Karen, right?
She plays the Karen and steals the film. I thought that she was just completely inappropriately appropriate. One of the tenets of the past year is race, I mean, in America. And it's just the way that every time she said blacks, she whispered it. It was a black.
No, she was brilliant. I loved the African doctor. You know,
just shaking his head.
Because they won't just stay on topic. You know, he's talking about science, and he's just like, we can't show anything because people will just start losing attention. You know, exactly. So they make fun of him, and I also like the red-haired woman. You know, who is termed the most average person in the world.
She was
funny. Her description of the election in the United States, how it all turns into a bizarre game show where the states are colored red or blue, and you had to flip. I mean, that was brilliant. He is the best satirist working right now. He really is.
So you really that was a great suggestion, by the way.
Good.
Over the last year, You've done this to me a few times where I was like, I don't really want to see this movie. And then I watched it. I'm like, this was really good. And this film was really good. And like I said, if they could just re-edit it, you're talking about a masterpiece on your hands. And it had to have dawned on them.
Yeah,
while they were editing, I would think, because it literally, they had data up to December 23rd in the movie. I was watching that. I'm like, how much? Oh, two more weeks.
I mean, the single most delicious thing to satire was 6 days after the year ended.
Yeah.
I mean, he really, you're right. He needs to go back and recut it.
But that was a great choice. And so the next time we reconvene, which will be in mid-March to start our season off, we're going to start to begin to talk about the upcoming Academy Awards, the nominees. You know, every year we kind of focus in on the best pictures to see as
this
many
year
as
they're
can.
Giving them out in April.
They are. Yeah. And so far, based on what happened in 2020, only three films qualify for Oscars. So it's going to be a short ceremony. I mean, coming up with 10 titles, I don't know how they're going to do it based on what the release schedule was. But they allowed the schedule for this year and this year only to go up until, I think, the middle of February. That's why. For that exact reason, because films weren't being released. So you're going to see some more films coming out.
Well, that's going to create problems for 2021 Oscars. But
yeah, yeah.
We'll worry about that later, Tom. Why don't you tell us
what
movie we'll be talking about?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because speaking of Oscar Best Picture nominees, this film is supposed to be nominated for Best Picture. It is the new film with Tom Hanks called The News of the World.
News of the World. Now, have you seen this?
No, not yet. But we have until March 14th to see it. And by then, it will be available on one of the streaming services.
It's on demand.
Exactly. It's on demand now, but it'll be like a $1.99 movie by then, I think. Or whatever.
I'm looking forward to seeing that, because we've seen it. This is good. I mean, this is a movie that neither of us have seen.
Correct.
So this will be, I'll be really interested to hear what you have to say, and I'm going to enjoy it thoroughly. All right. So until 14th of March, we are Two Peas in a Podcast. Have a good one.
I'll bang the drum slowly and play the fife lowly, play the dead march as they carry me along. Put bunches of roses all over my coffin, roses to deaden the clods as they